Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hello, thanks for joining us. Many of you may have been blown away by the Leroy Smith story. And if you remember, if you did see that one, if you haven't seen it, links in the description box, but if you did see it, so Leroy tells the story of how he ended up incarcerated for over 20 years and he had shot 2 cops. Now, James Seymour here is the cop. And he has actually written a chapter of this book. He's thinking about doing his own book as well. And we urge you to go down in the description box and support these guys' work because they're doing joint events together. It's like, you know, I was at a school talk a couple of years ago and it was the Brighton Bombers. One of his victims' daughters was doing a talk with the Brighton Bomber. My head was like, whoa, this is something else. But to educate people about crime, the dangers of getting involved in the lifestyle, we've got to salute, you know, this kind of positive public speaking. Definitely. And events and news stories. And Leroy's book, again, is called Out of the Box, The Full Story. So, my goodness, huge thanks for coming on, James.
Yeah, thank you.
Pleasure.
Yeah.
Pleasure.
So we're very interested in your life story specifically. And we're going to go back then perhaps to the early years to figure out what it was like for you as a young person. And, you know, were you like, when I grew up, I'm going to be a cop? Was that in your head or did that come later?
No, it came much later on. When I was younger, all I wanted to do was, 16, was leave school, have some money, have a girlfriend, learn to drive. So basically, that's what I did.
Yeah.
I came from a very religious background. And I'll be honest, I'm quite ashamed to say it. I did rebel. And I just took the first job I could when I was 16, doing unskilled labour, and got to 21 and thought, I've got to do something in my life. So it was either the army or the police. So I became a special constable in Kent for a few months and then decided, yeah, that's where I wanted to go with my career.
What was the procedure to become a special constable?
I think you just applied, got an interview, and obviously you were vetted and that was it. But if I'm honest, I didn't really learn a lot or deal with a lot. So,
what was the vetting process?
Just filling out loads of form about your family background. And I think same as when I joined the regular force in the Met, you have a lifestyle interview. And obviously there's different levels of vetting for whatever different rank or roles that you have in the police.
Did you have to do like a physical test?
Yes. Yeah. And it's certainly not as hard as it was now.
Was it a beep test?
No, it wasn't. You had to do, when I joined the Met, you had to do a 1.5 mile run in, I think it was 10 minutes, 10 or 12 minutes. And then you had to do a minimum of 30 push-ups and a minimum of 38 sit-ups. And you had to do a standing long jump, which I never understood the meaning of it. But I failed it all on the first go.
You failed it?
Yeah, failed it, yeah. So they gave me 4 months to go and train. And so I went back and passed with flying colours. And so then I started at Hendon on basic training in July 1984.
And what was your life like outside of work at that point of, you know, when you were in the early 20s?
Like I say, just had a girlfriend, just went to the pub and didn't have any special hobbies. I love sport, still do, but nothing really great, to be honest. I was very quite shy in those days, and certainly I had to change that when I joined the police.
Yeah.
And that changed within literally months of me joining.
Really? So what challenges were presented that forced you to come out of your shyness?
Just basically because you've got to talk to the public. You know, and in those days, you spent a lot more time out on patrol on your own. So you didn't have an older, more experienced colleague to help you out. You had to work it out for yourself. So that was a massive thing for me.
So you were like in a patrol car, were you?
No, basically you did a lot more foot patrol in those days.
Foot patrol?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
On your own?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And so you just fresh in and they send you out on your own right away?
You, not right away. You do what was called a street duties course for 10 weeks. So you had an older, mature officer that would take you out and you go and deal with calls and just guide you in the right direction in all aspects of the job. And then after that 10 weeks, a lot of the time, yeah, you were out there fending for yourself.
When you went out with that older experienced officer, what kind of encounters were you having with the public? Was it...
Yeah, it was obviously doing some of it was for like traffic offences. We went and dealt with calls. I dealt with my first suicide on those 10 weeks.
Oh, what was that?
Which is in the book. And that was, it was quite sad, really. It was a fellow who lived on his own, didn't have any friends or family. And he went to Fortin Heath railway station and put his head on the tracks and. Obviously, his head got severed, and that's my first dead body I'd ever seen. And that made me grow up overnight.
Oh, God.
But it's one of those things that everybody's looking at you, and you've got to get on and deal with it. There's nobody else.
You're
it's like, down to
you're
you.
You're one of the first at the scene, are you?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Somebody, you've got to pick up the head. I remember we were walking past, and yeah, you have to do that. I mean, it was different in those days because we're talking 1984, yeah. But with it, where his hands, he'd clenched his fists. And so we had to break his fingers and take fingerprints from him. And I remember getting £17 to do that.
17 quid?
Yeah. And obviously the rigor mortis had set in. So you literally had to break his fingers and take fingerprints. But yeah, welcome to policing. And that was in my first 10 weeks that was. Yeah. So most officers now, they have to go and see a post-mortem. But I didn't have to because I have seen one since and it is really, really interesting. And that sounds a bit gruesome, but it is. They are such clever people. They really are. So I didn't have to do that. But that was, one of my first bad experiences in policing.
When you are in a situation like that where you're breaking fingers and handling the head and stuff, do you have to have counselling after that?
It wasn't really any in those days. But you used to talk a lot more to each other. And that's something that's missing in the police service now is... People out on patrol now hardly see each other, you know, because canteens have been taken away. We used to have the control room where you'd all meet up at regular times. And you talk about your experiences and that would really help you. But there was counselling available. I don't know how good it was. I certainly didn't have any in those days.
So what was the next major challenge then?
Major challenge, you mean what, as in
something psychologically that could have affected you, something that like was a tricky situation, maybe you had to pursue a criminal and the criminal
I
got
think
away
1987 I dealt with a 6 week old baby that had been stabbed. You know, obviously
God.
We tried to save him.
Talk us through that one.
And basically mum was suffering from postnatal depression. And she lived in a flat in Croydon that wasn't fit to live in, you know. Obviously things just got to her, and we turned up and tried to save this baby, but we didn't.
Oh my God. And you just died.
You know, you do your best, and
I mean you just feel like
Jesus. That was 1987, so I had 3 years service then.
Oh, wow.
So, but, I mean, that's quite freakish for those two things, you know. Unfortunately, in my career, I've had a lot of stuff happen to me that a lot of officers might do 30 years and not experience.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can't believe what I'm hearing. That's one of the most intense things I've ever heard. I've interviewed almost 1,000 people, and that is just...
But,
poor little thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what, the thing with it, and you say, I've always wondered what happened to mum. You know, it's very easy to turn around and say how bad that is. But what happened to her, I don't know. You know, but clearly to do something like that, you're seriously mentally disturbed, aren't you?
Of course.
And not necessarily your fault.
We've got a guest called Dr. Das, and he worked at Broadmoor. And people like that some of them end up with him. And one woman had murdered her brother's baby.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. She went into a psychosis.
Yeah.
But she, the family took her back and everything because they understood that, you know, she'd been through this. And yeah, it was a horrible situation.
How do you deal with it?
Mm. Yeah. All right. So after that situation then, are you thinking, like you just earlier said, you know, for some reason, many things have happened in your career trajectory. Because these things happened early on, are you thinking, well, maybe this is the right career for me, or maybe this isn't the right career for me? Are you rethinking your occupation? Or
no, I think because when I first joined, the first 4 years I joined, I was in what's called a section house. Yeah, so there was like about 100 of us single men and women living in, you had your own like apartment in, I lived at Tooting, and it was just party. It was just great fun.
Some nice restaurants.
So that side took you away from the sinister side of policing, if you like.
Yeah.
Because
it
was, coming from my background, it was a real eye-opener for me, and I made the most of it, I'll be honest.
So yeah, let's talk about your good times then.
Well, you just, basically, everybody worked the same shift pattern. So depending, didn't matter what station you worked at, you'd all the same people would be off. So you'd go out, and living in Tooting is easy to get the tube uptown and
go in the curry houses,
party all night. Yeah.
Sure,
you know, or go down to Croydon, you know.
Yeah.
And it was just fun times, real fun times. And I know I said, you know, about two horrendous things I dealt with, but a lot of stuff, it was just good fun. You know, and I'll be honest, going out there catching criminals was good fun.
Take us through catching your first criminal. What was the situation? What was the, was it called in? Or?
I got called to Tesco's in Fulton Heath for, a prostitute and her partner had been doing what was called kiting checks in those days. Oh. So we were stealing checkbooks and signing them off, obviously, and buying goods that way. And I didn't know what I was doing. But I had an older experienced PC with me who helped me through it all. So that was my first arrest. And it's quite funny, you never forget your first arrest.
Did they give chase?
No, they didn't. No. A basic security guard had caught them, and it was all what we call given into custody. So they'd already been captured by somebody.
What was your first one where there was problems? Like
the and a chase.
The first one I had, I remember, was a young lad was drink driving on his motorbike. And he couldn't really get on it. So he was drunk in charge, basically. And so I went to arrest him, and he didn't like that. So we ended up having a bit of a fight, shall we put it that way? Mm. Yeah. And so I had to call for help with my colleagues and turn up, and got a few scuffs out, you know, a few little cuts and bruises. But I know it sounds a bit weird, but when you... early 20s, it's a bit of fun.
It's exciting, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, spot on, you know. And it sounds wrong, but it is.
Of course,
you know?
Yeah.
And I remember when he sobered up, he was as nice as anything.
Very apologetic.
And so many times you see that as a police officer, where somebody absolutely shows a real hatred for you. But then afterwards, when they sober up or they come off their high, they're
full
as nice
remorse.
As anything.
Yeah.
Different people. You see it so many times.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. So did they train you in like any martial arts or restraints or anything like that?
Yeah, you do. In those days, you didn't do as much as you do now. Now officer safety is taken very, very seriously.
Yeah.
And that sort of came in about the time of our shooting, mid-90s. That's when it really started to come in. But in those days, we did have some. I can't say how good it was, and the equipment wasn't so good. So you only had chain link handcuffs and a balsa wood truncheon. Whereas obviously now you're looking at taser, you're looking at rigid handcuffs, you know, friction lock batons, a lot more protection now than what, and body armour, which we never had.
So, Talk about your first time with the baton, that you used it.
I remember it was... I'm going to get done here, aren't I? I think the first time I used it was... Crystal Palace versus Birmingham.
Right.
Yeah, because Crystal Palace was my local team that working at South Norwood. I remember they were saying it was going to be a party atmosphere. Well, it wasn't much of a party, I've got to say. And the fans just went crazy, and they were throwing seats at the police, ripping the seats up, throwing them at police. And then they spilt onto the pitch, and it was all kicking off. But it was good fun. So obviously you've got to defend yourself, haven't you? Because both sets of fans want to have a go at us. So it's a case of, you know, look after yourself.
When there's that many people around you,
Oh, God.
Is it a bit of a head? Does it do something strange to your head? Because it could get out of control very easily, couldn't it?
It does.
By virtue of numbers.
You're always looking out for your colleagues, always covering your colleagues' back, looking out for each other, making sure they don't get separated, things like that.
Did anyone get hurt?
I think a lot of people got hurt that day, public and police. Yeah.
Did you get hurt in any situations like that?
In that one, no.
But there were other ones you did get hurt.
Got hit with missiles a couple of times.
Like bottles and stuff.
I remember one of the worst times was, do you remember the newspaper strike? It was up at out east. I'm trying to think what it was now.
Whopping.
That's Whopping. It, yeah. Yeah. And I remember there was a line of us there, and this missiles, it's like, it's a bit of a police saying, yeah, you couldn't see the sky for missiles, but it was thick. Yeah. And I remember a couple of us got hit, and a girl got hit with a bottle in the nose next to me.
Ooh.
And, it was just, it wasn't nice. I got hit with a bottle at Notting Hill Carnival in 1987. But I couldn't show anything because I was going on an 18 to 30s holiday the next day. So I had to limp along with blood pouring out of my knee. So I didn't tell anyone about that one, but I still got the scar there.
Wow.
How did that kick off at Notting Hill?
Basically, when they used to turn the sound systems down at 8 o'clock, is a lot of people didn't want that to happen. The police are the first people in authority. And we're talking a minority because I've policed a Notting Hill Carnival many a times. Mm. And I remember sometimes I had just had the best time of my life, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Eating Caribbean food, dancing with the ladies. they're wearing their hats and stuff like that. But it's all changed a lot now.
Yeah, so what position are you in at the police in these early years then?
Just a constable on the emergency response teams.
Constable on emergency response teams.
Yeah, and obviously you have to do what we call aid. So you have to go to football matches, Notting Hill Carnival, New Year's Eve, police demonstrations. You know, some of it is really enjoyable, like Trooping the Colour. Fantastic.
What's that?
Trooping the Colour.
What's
at Buckingham Palace.
The Royal Family.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Yeah, stuff like that. Because it's a different side to policing because all the public want to be there. They're very pro-royal, aren't they? And so... Mm. They tend to be very pro-police, you know, and you don't really get any aggravation, and it's just nice times.
Any Royal Protection cops? Any Royal Protection cops?
Do I know any?
Yeah.
I train quite a few.
Oh, you train them?
Yeah. If they do driving courses, I train them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
What's that like?
Same as you and I. It's just normal people.
Yeah.
But obviously they're trained in different... different ways of, obviously, in their case, protection.
Okay.
So the people I train all sorts of people from traffic officers to arms response officers to surveillance officers, all sorts.
So how many years were you responding to emergencies for?
21 years.
21 years?
Yeah.
And what is the definition of emergencies? What are included in that?
Basically, that would be... It's not all 999 calls, but a lot of them are. So what I did, because I did the driving courses, so I did my pursuit driving and my advanced driving. So you would get the real emergency calls, the 999 calls, stuff that's happening now. So you've got to be there straight away. Whereas some of the other calls you deal with, you might have to go and investigate a burglary or something, and that would be, you wouldn't have to get there straight away. You'd have a mixture of both, but generally speaking, I was on what's called the area car at the time. So that's the fast, high performance and your pursuit trains. So
what was your first vehicle pursuit?
That's what I was going to ask.
I was quite young at the time and I was the operator and I didn't know what to do. So my driver talked me through it. And I remember we chased this vehicle and it went into cul-de-sac and they ran off and I was... fairly fit then, and I managed to get them. So
did you?
Stolen car, yeah. So
you just legged it after them?
Yeah.
They're jumping up walls and stuff?
No, it wasn't. I think they went in a cul-de-sac and they sort of, you know, trapped themselves, really. So that was an easy one.
Yeah.
Have you jumped over any hedges?
Yeah, I have done before. Yeah, yeah, like sometimes. Yeah, yeah, if you get like suspects in gardens and that. And it's quite strange because I think most police officers have done it is you've got to climb over a fence, but you haven't climbed over it, you've gone through it, you know. Yeah. So, of course, we have to report it as damage to people's property, and obviously they got compensated. But, yeah, it does happen sometimes. Or you think something's secure, or another thing, you might jump over a wall or something, not realise how deep the drop is the other side, and because you don't always know what you're going into.
Oh, there's a dog there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Has that happened?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, sometimes you think, no, I'm not going in that garden or whatever.
You know.
But, yeah, so, yeah, it is, for me, it was exciting. Mm. It was fun. It was exciting. It was stressful at times, but I think they outweigh each other. And the friendship you build up with your colleagues and that is just, you know, you're looking out for each other. I think it's lacking nowadays. I really do. Mm. In society, yeah, not just the police. Yeah. But there, yeah, you really looked out for each other.
Good. So you've talked about two fatalities then so far. What was the next fatality that you encountered?
I can't remember what the next one was. In chronological order, I can't really remember. I remember I dealt with, I think it's in the book, about a Rastafarian drug dealer that I tried to save in South Norwood, who'd been obviously owed somebody some money and had slashed him across the stomach with a machete, and obviously all his intestines are hanging out. And myself and a colleague, again, I tried to keep everything in his body, but he was clearly dying when we got there. But his mum and his sister were there, and you've got to do your bit. You've got to try for these people. And I remember at the end, they weren't very pro-police, but at the end, they were so grateful to me and my colleague for trying to save him.
Yeah.
And that says it all to me. So that was just before I went to Brixton, because there, in those days, every 5 or 6 years, you got transferred. So you didn't get over-familiarised with each other, which might lead to corruption, stuff like that. So I got sent to Brixton after that.
What was Brixton like?
Yeah, lively.
Yeah?
There's a lot going on in a very small area. And in those days, every single shift, you'd have an armed call.
Right.
You know, we had an armed response vehicle just posted to Brixton in those days. But obviously, they might get called away somewhere else. And it was a lot happening in a much smaller area. And the drug dealing was just so open on the streets. Loughborough Junction, Railton Road, Atlantic Road, Landor Road. It was just open. You could get anything you wanted there any time of the day.
So did you work with like the undercovers?
I didn't know. We used to do some work with them. Like if they were doing a raid, we'd work together. We might have to go in plain clothes and help them out if we were on a spare shift, yeah, because we used to have 5 shifts and one was spare.
Right.
So then you might help out doing stuff like that, which we did quite regularly, which was quite good fun, but the results weren't brilliant.
What sort of sense?
As in, actually, because a lot of the dealers didn't have the drugs on them. You know, they take you elsewhere to get them. They'll have a stash hidden around the corner somewhere. Or they'd have somebody else delivering the drugs for them, push bike example, you know, and we're talking teenagers.
Yeah, of course.
You know, that was an eye-opener for me, was the openness of it all. Whereas there was a lot of dealing going on in places like South Nord and Croydon, but most of it was behind closed doors, so you didn't physically see it, but there, and the prostitutes as well, you know, Brixton Hill, and that, it was just so open.
Mm. What about gun crime in Brixton?
Yeah, as I said, every shift you get an armed call.
An armed call every shift?
And you're looking at an area that's probably 2 miles square, you know, and some of it you just went as a normal... Wow. Bobby.
So what is an armed call? Does that mean like someone's reporting a gun, someone's reporting gunfire, there's a gunman lurking?
Yeah, it could be anything. It could be anything from shots fired. It's quite strange, actually, because coming on to that is I remember going to a call that was shots had been fired through a window Yeah. Little did I know it was Leroy Smith who had done it. Yeah.
Okay.
It's in the book. Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? And now we've talked about it since together. Something like that. Somebody might have been in possession of a gun. Somebody might have been threatened with a gun.
So does that require like a tactical response unit?
Yeah, it does now. In those days, yes, it was just sort of like the beginning of the armed response unit. Whereas now, it's
how would you kit up back then?
Well, you literally just had your truncheon and your handcuffs. No body armor.
No bulletproof vest or anything?
No, not in those days. That started to come out. Yeah, no, it didn't.
Oh my goodness.
There was some available, but it wasn't an open thing that everybody had it. You had some in the cars that you could put on if you went to a call, but it wasn't, not everybody had them in their cars.
Oh,
you know? But I mean, we're talking early 90s. So we're talking a long time ago. I mean, now the armed response vehicles, they are phenomenal. The equipment they've got and their tactics, phenomenal. Fantastic people.
But didn't you feel vulnerable going out without?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I was going to say.
Absolutely. Yeah,
did you voice? Did you voice that to your colleagues?
Yeah, everybody knew, and it's one of those things that you, and I do accept that police officers shouldn't expect to get assaulted, but you've got to be real. If you go out there in those environments, something is going to happen to you. It's just a case of how severe.
Mm.
That's the way that we looked at it. And I think the other day, in those days, if you had what we call a roll around with a prisoner, like with a nice drunk fella, is you'd expect to get a few cuts and bruises. You didn't report his assault on police. It was part and parcel of the job, you know. Whereas now you're really encouraged to report stuff like that, you know.
All documented.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing, you know.
So on these firearms calls then, what kind of things did you personally experience?
I can remember going to a call where it's usual call. It's what we call an abandoned call for police. So someone's phoned 999 and they just heard screaming at the end of the phone. That's it. The line's gone dead. I remember we got called to this address and you need to really go in and make sure everyone's okay. And there was a woman at the top of the stairs and she said, no, she was clearly upset. And she said, no, I'm all right. There's nothing wrong with me. There's nobody else here. I'm totally okay. And I haven't really got anything else we can do. We've got nothing else to go on. And she said, I've railed my partner and he's disappeared.
Right.
Well, we've got no power to go in there. She's got no physical injuries that we can see. And it turned out next day that her partner had got a gun to her back at the time.
Oh,
yeah. God. And we didn't know that at the time. So we gone in. That could have been...
Was she okay?
Different. Yeah, I think she was, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, a lot of this stuff, a lot of people, certainly in those days, they didn't follow it up. You know, the way that domestic violence was dealt with is so much different nowadays, you know, and
police
for the better.
Have the right to take
for
it
the
into
better.
Your own hands.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, much better than what it used to be.
Of course.
Did you arrive on the scene where other people had been shot?
Yes, I did. I remember going to we was in the canteen, sounds of, someone had been shot in Brixton Academy, right opposite. It had been a big reggae party or something. And by the time we got there, all the evidence had been discarded and gone. And, somebody had been shot dead there.
Oh, wow.
So,
shot dead.
Yeah.
Grief.
Yeah.
So what other challenges were there in Brixton for you?
Obviously, because of the 1981 riots, there was a lot of deep feeling, and I would say sometimes almost hatred towards the police. But I'm not saying it's necessarily a one-sided thing. Yeah, okay. It takes two, doesn't it? You know? And I'm glad to say we've really moved on a long, long way from those days. So sometimes if you stop somebody in the street, you might get surrounded, you know? And obviously now it's different. Everyone's out. As soon as you stop somebody, the mobile phones are out and it's not easy for the officers. It's not easy. You know, in our day, it wasn't easy, but it was different.
Yeah, we interviewed Peter Blexley. He said the same thing.
Yeah.
He was in Brixton.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you ever working alongside him?
I know the name.
Yeah.
But I've not actually worked with him.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was another issue.
I think he was there when the riot went off.
Yeah,
he was working when the riot went off.
Because they had riots in 81 and obviously
before your time, isn't it?
85, yeah. 85 I was there.
85.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, where I was, there was somebody called Leroy Smith on the other side throwing stuff at us. And it's amazing how you meet up later on in life and got these stories is, you know.
Definitely.
It's our story is just amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Did you have to respond to any riot situations?
As in, straight away, no. This generally, it was... the 85 one, we went up from South Norwood, a load of us. They're just calling for reinforcements.
And what happened there?
We got deployed, and I can still remember it, is that I was deployed on this shield unit, and we used to have three long shields and three officers and two at the back. I remember being on the outside shield, so you're a little bit exposed on the outside, and the middle guy was an ex-Marine, ex-Falklands.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
And he said, do you want to spot places, son? And I said, no, I'll stay here. And he said to me, I was in the Falklands, he's gone, and I'm more scared now.
Mm.
Amazing.
Wow. Yeah. And what did it look like on the streets?
We didn't actually get, we had a few missiles thrown at us on that occasion, where I was, but I can't say it was really horrendous. It's the thought of what might happen, not what actually is happening at the time. Yeah.
So it didn't get that bad?
Not where I was. I know some officers
did. People died, didn't they, in that?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I think 81 they did.
Oh, 81 was it?
85. Okay. I don't know. I don't know. It's a long time ago.
Yeah.
What were the hairiest situations for you then over your entire career?
I think I got commended 10 times for bravery, which is quite a lot.
Wow.
What's the first one then?
Yeah.
The first one's really interesting. I was in South Norwood, and my operator, I was driving the emergency response vehicle, the area car, and it was her birthday. So we went into Lowiston Road in Croydon to get some cakes for the troops. Yeah. And this man walked out of a jeweller's shop. It was middle of summer, and he's got an overcoat on. He's got gloves on. And he's got like one of these metal camera cases, and he sees us, and the body language is just, I don't like this. And he just runs off. So we go after him, and he jumps on a bus. So we jump on, and as we get to him, he just pulls out a massive knife, which we managed to grab hold of his arm, have a big fight with him, and transpired he'd tied up all the staff and stolen £16,000 worth of jewellery in those days. So it was a nice little job, but, you know, if the timing had been a couple of seconds later, I might not be here, you know?
Oh, wow.
So that was the first one I had.
What was the second one?
I'm trying to think what the second one was now. I went to a call in Brixton in a block of flats where abandoned call, sound of disturbance, that's all it was. And I was with my colleague, and I thought he was behind me, and I see this door open and a woman crying. So I go in, next thing is, the door slammed behind me, and I've got a carving knife to my throat.
Oh.
And it's like, this man is just high on crack. I'll never forget his eyes, never. And he said, I can either jump out the 13th floor, or I can be stabbed. They made me take my kit belt off, because then we had the kit belts. So that's when he just come in. And and my colleague had been locked outside, so he couldn't get in. But luckily, the girl that had... called us, she'd managed to crawl to the front door and open it so the rest of my team could get in. And I remember just trying to talk sense into this bloke, and in the end he got arrested. And
how did you get the knife off?
Basically, when the troops turned up, I just grabbed them.
What, spun around?
He had two carving knives that he put in a cross in front of me. He goes, pick your knife. Yeah. And his eyes just... Yeah.
What was going through your head?
Just got to talk to him. What do you do? just got to talk to him.
What were you saying?
So, just, you know, what's it all about? You know, I've married issues at home and all that. You know, it's not just you. It happens to all of us. I'm the same as anyone else. I just wear a uniform. I just do a job. And,
were you calm?
Yeah. Yeah, you got to be. Yeah. Because if you show any, you've got to be calm or try and be calm. You're not inside, but outside, you've got to try and show it so it doesn't, provoke the situation. So that was another one.
Oh,
wow. I'm trying to think. One quite recently when I was at the driving school, funny enough, is, I was doing a dem drive on blue lights and I came down through, I forget where it is now, North London. Was it Finsbury Road? Something like that. And I see a, security call van parked up with hazard lights on. And when we do our drive and we do commentary, as in what we're seeing, what we're doing, what we intend to do about stuff. I remember seeing two fellas run across the road and I said, oh, I bet they've been naughty boys. And of course everybody laughs. I've got three students with me, PCs. And, the security guard flags down and says, oh, they've just nicked my cash box. No mention of firearms, nothing. So, members of public are pointing down this side road and, I drive into the side road and this Golf GTI makes off. Well, I'm a bit old, so it's like, right, I'm having you. Yeah. Okay. So we give chase and, we did have equipment in those days, but it's in the boot of the car because we're training. Yeah. And you didn't think about coming across something like this. Anyway, they go into a cul-de-sac and they get out. And they run off, and as you're running off, one of them from about 25 yards just pulls a handgun out and fires two shots at us under his left armpit. Where they went, I don't know. I don't need to know. And again, we had a massive fight with one of them because they separated.
Yeah.
One of them got followed by two officers, and the ARVs came and took them out at knife point, at gunpoint, sorry, and he had a weapon on him with two rounds missing. And we, myself and a female colleague, we challenged the other person and had a massive fight with him. She ended up in hospital. And in the car was about 10 grand's worth in cash.
All right, so that's three of them.
Yeah.
So what's the other seven?
I think one of them was when I worked at Bromley. I had one at Bromley where a fella was just, I'd had some domestic issues and just walking down a road in Penge with a carving knife. And obviously that's what we get called to. And I remember telling him to see sense, put the knife down, and he was walking away from us. So I had CS sprayed in those days, but I couldn't use it because it's back to us, so it's a bit pointless. Mm. And he, eventually he did see sense. But again, it was one of those touch and go moments. You can't just go and grab him from the rear because he could just turn around and, you know, that could be bad. Another one I had was in.
What do you mean by he saw sense?
I managed to talk him round to drop
him. What did you say?
And, drop
the knife.
Probably said, probably told him, armed police were on the way, put it down or you get shot, you know?
Yeah.
Another one I had in Bromley was, there was, we were driving down Bromley High Street in the early hours, just hear this girl screaming, and somebody ran off. A bloke ran off when he saw the police car. So basically he's tried to grab this girl at knife point, and I chased a suspect and ended up catching up with him. Again, we're having a bit of a fight. He's got, I've got a knife, I'm going to stab you, I'm going to kill you. And I'll be honest, I lost it with him. Yeah, because I can, because I need to defend my life.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And I hurt him. And I'm pleased I hurt him.
Good.
Yeah. And basically, he had got this knife and I wasn't really happy. We managed, I can't remember how we managed to do it, but we went round to his house and did what we called in the old days a Section 18, Police and Criminal Evidence Act, to search his premises. And we found a load of child pornography in his house.
Ooh.
And these handcuffs and straps and belts where he was obviously going to do something to somebody. And
did he know the woman?
No.
She was like stalking her.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So,
oh my God, well done with that one.
Yeah,
yeah, well done.
And there's arrested a burglar in Brixton. We got trapped in a office with him. And what? He assaulted six officers.
How'd you get trapped in an office?
It just, because we climbed him through the like the skylight at the top because he'd been surrounded. We couldn't get into the building. That's how he got in. So somehow he's got in. And so we just climb in. And the next thing is we can't get out, can we? Because we're locked in this office block.
And he wants to fight all
and
of
he wants, yeah, and he's high on most things. Yeah.
And, so he's not feeling pain.
Yeah, yeah.
He's lively.
Absolutely.
He's lively.
So,
he's lively.
Yeah, he got convicted of 8 assaults. Great. On police officers.
Did he whack, again, nothing. Did he whack
really
you?
Really
that, yeah, yeah, yeah. He pushed me into, I'll cut my back open, pushed me into a locker, steel locker.
So. Was it dark as well in the...
It was a bit of sunlight coming, not sunlight, a bit of street light coming through, but it was yeah,
kind of like fairly fighting dark.
In dark. Yeah. It's like something from a movie.
So, yeah, that was one. And, yeah, he's... like I said, it's an unusual career I had. Very unusual.
Yeah.
But one I'm proud of as well.
Of course.
Well, we've got five more.
Three. Yeah, I'll three or four, isn't it?
Yeah.
Three or four.
Difficult for me to think of all
think
of them.
Did two at once.
Yeah, it's got
two. I was trying to count. I thought you were up to six.
I can't think.
So when you get this award then for bravery,
you get different levels. You get different levels. So, like obviously the shooting with Leroy,
that was one. Yeah,
that was one. And I got a special inspector's one, which is unofficial, but that for me meant so much.
Where did you get that one?
That was at Brixton for the shooting. Right. So I got one from the commissioner for that. So you have different levels of commendations. So like the ones with the knives at Bromley, that was like what they call a barrow commendation. Yeah, so for the shooting, I got a commissioner's. You can get higher commissioners. That's like for people that challenge the terrorists, like at London Bridge and places like that, and rightfully so. And then obviously you can go above that with the, I think it's the George Cross, I think it is. It's the next one above that, which one or two people have had. So that was it.
Did you have any dealings with terrorists, the IRA or anything like that?
Obviously been to incidents or might be on a cordon, but that's it.
Yeah.
So, I'm glad to say.
So before we get to the, you know, what happened with Leroy then, what other intense things happened in your career that we've not talked about?
Or have you been shot more times?
were you shot?
No, I'm due one.
Prior to Leroy, anyone took a shot at you?
No, that was afterwards. That's since I've been at the drama school. That was in 2007.
So what was the most harm ever done to you prior to Leroy?
Leroy.
I have been assaulted a couple of times, but only probably actual bodily harm, you know, black eye, something like that.
Black eye?
Something like that, yeah. But not anything really, really severe.
Were they like drunken people? Or?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Yeah.
Is that a bad call out when you got to go in and
someone's pissed,
maneuver some drunks?
It is hard.
Yeah.
And it is hard because you have to justify your use of force, and sometimes people look at it and think, yeah, that's disproportionate. But actually, when you're there at the time, it's not. It's like I hear people, they say, well, why does it take five people to restrain somebody? Have you ever seen somebody, including women, who when they kick off? They absolutely kick off and they don't, as you said, Sean, they don't feel any pain, you know. But now, like I said to you, it's changing because of the equipment we've got is really, really so, so much better.
What about other corpses you encountered then after the Jamaican guy died? Was there any more fatalities?
I've been to several fatal accidents.
Okay.
Just like road traffic accidents.
Yeah. Been to several. Couple of other suicides. One was really, really sad. I won't forget it because she was a young girl that was training to be an athlete, and she hadn't made the grade for England. And she went to do the usual hose pipe in a car in a wooded area. And we got there just before she died. But literally about 4 weeks later...
What did that look like?
We got a call to the same location and she'd actually done it. And that's because her career hadn't gone the way she wanted to.
That's one hell of a way to kill yourself.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
It is, yeah. I dealt with another similar one where a guy, his wife had been seeing someone else and he'd done the same thing, you know, and left a suicide note. And it's so sad. It's so sad. You know, that some people, sometimes people don't think they can get help, but there is help out there, and especially nowadays. I can remember dealing with another suicide that was in Brixton, and I don't know if I should say this or not, but his parents were on way down. It wasn't gruesome, it was tablets. Drinking tablets, yeah. And he's a young lad who, again, he hasn't achieved what he wanted to in life. And his family were coming down, so the place was a mess. So me and a colleague tidied it up before his parents came down. Bloody just as a token for us, yeah. As a bit of relief, and say, look, they can't see this. They're going through enough grief, you know. And I'll never forget that. It was just, I don't know why you think of things like that. Why you do it, I don't know, but it made us feel good.
Can you imagine your business message sprawled across the side of a building with bright lights and brilliant colours blazing forth? Through the magic of the out-of-the-box approach, everyday architecture becomes show-stopping advertising. Are you ready to make people pay attention to what you have to say? You're ready for out-of-the-box custom projector screens. We can place large-scale, captivating ads on the sides of buildings, turning bland walls into instant works of art, with you at the centre. This grassroots option, offering an incredible amount of flexibility and awareness, allows you to explore your edgy side, putting something out there that's sure to get people talking while illuminating the night with your brand's message. This form of advertising is all about the element of surprise, which is why projection media is one of the best ways of getting your business noticed. When we transform buildings into brand-bolstering digital billboards and place them in high traffic areas where plenty of eyes will be unable to avoid advertisement, our clients are beyond thrilled. We'd love to do the same for your business. The bottom line here is that it's impossible for this promotion tactic to go unnoticed, and when accompanied by other marketing elements, your brand will be the buzz for weeks to come. Now, doesn't that sound exciting? The Out of the Box staff is a fearless crew of folk, so we don't believe in limits. Our team will help you create a campaign that's perfect for your unique goals. Promoting an event, launching a new product, strategizing to increase your social media game. Projection advertising is the perfect complement for any advertising effort that wants to attract a massive audience.
Did you ever get stuck in any tricky situations?
Not really. Only the one I said to you, where the in the flats with fella with a knife.
Yeah,
that was where I'd say yeah, I got stuck. Yeah. But lucky it was only for a few minutes.
All right, so let's go.
Start the Leroy story.
Start the serious stuff.
What year did this happen? Where were you at in your career? And take us through the day.
Right, I was working at Brixton, 1994. I was late shift. So went to work as normal. I was driving the area car. You know, your advanced car, pursuit trained. It was just a normal late turn. It was busy. And I was with a younger colleague. I had a young family then, big mortgage. So I used to look for a couple of hours overtime because my wife then would be in bed. So what's the point of coming home to an empty room? You know, might as well earn a couple of hours extra.
Of course.
So in those days, there was a pub called the Atlantic Pub. The pub is there now, but it's a lot different. it was run by an old West Indian called Louis. He was a lovely fella, but he couldn't stop the drug dealing going on. And it had two doors. It's right in the corner of Atlantic Road and Cold Harbour Lane. So if you saw somebody going one door and out the other within 2 or 3 minutes or that, you knew they bought gear. Yeah. So easy to justify. You stop and search, and if you had a bit of puff, sometimes you might get, you know, some rocks or something. Yeah. Take me into custody for a couple of hours. What happened to them? Caution or charge? I wasn't really too bothered about it. It's the extra hours to process them that we were interested in. So on this day, we decided to do that. And as we drive along the road, we see this motorbike overtakes us, two fellas on it. And one of them, Leroy, was the pillion passenger, gets off, goes in one door in Atlantic. The motorbike rider speeds off, goes through a red light. Well, I'm not going to bother giving chase on a high-performance motorbike. No. Yeah, pointless, yeah. Okay, so Leroy's gone in the pub, so we turn a corner, and as we turn a corner, we see the rider has obviously parked the bike up, still got his crash helmet on, and he sees us, and the body language is like, it's the old Bill, yeah? Yeah? Isn't it? It's the gathers, yeah, I'm done.
Stand up.
You know, and he's just like, he's stopped in his tracks. Still got his crash helmet on. So myself and Simon turn into Rushcroft Road where he'd parked the bike, see the bike, do a vehicle check on it. No current keeper. The old suspicions are growing now, aren't they? So we spin round the block and now we see Leroy and his colleague in a chicken takeaway shop just round the corner from the pub, crash helmet still on. They might have been tilted back slightly, but they were still on. So again, what's that all about? So Leroy's been in the pub for a minute, 2 minutes maximum. Something's not right. A bike that's not registered. It's all starting to get together now, and the bike's done a red light. It's all not just not right, is it? So I think often as a police officer, you do get a sixth sense sometimes, yeah? Okay. The facts are there, but it's like saying, yeah, we've got to stop these people, but we want to get them on the bike. Yeah, okay, or with the bike. So we spin round the block again, and as we pull into Rushcroft this time, they're just about to get onto the bike. Okay, so I pull up the police car, all chilled out and that, alongside. We get out and we tell them, yeah, take your crash helmets off. We've seen you at the drugs pub. You've only been there for a very short time. You haven't taken your helmets off. It's a drugs pub, yeah, going to search you for drugs. And there wasn't any real change until we separated them. Yeah, so I go to search the rider, okay, and my colleague goes to search Leroy. So we separate them, textbook stop, back to back, so they can't converse with each other. And my guy drops something on the floor, and I think that's rocks, yeah? So I go to push him against the wall so I can secure the evidence. Yeah, and out my peripheral vision, I see Leroy struggling with my colleague. My colleague is quite a bit bigger than Leroy because there's not a lot to him, is there? Yeah, and he's nearly got the better of him. And then literally just before I pushed my bloke against the wall, the atmosphere just changed. Can't say what it was. It changed. Yeah, something is seriously not right now. Seriously not right. We've gone over that line. We've gone too far. You can't go back now. You can't go back, yeah? And the atmosphere just changed. And then I just see Leroy pull a handgun out, hits my colleague in his thigh, goes off, breaks his leg.
Ooh.
Okay? And Leroy's told me to disappear. And that's when things slow down, slow motion, yeah? This isn't really happening, yeah? This is a nightmare. The alarm's going to go off in a minute, but it is happening. Yeah, and it's almost like, I don't know if you ever had an accident, but you almost see it happening before it happens, and there's nothing you can, it's that sort of thing, but intensified by 100 times, that's the way I describe it. And I literally, Leroy tells me to do one, in other words, obviously, and I literally turn round. What do you do? You've got an injured colleague screaming in pain, yeah? I have got nothing to protect myself. I am totally, totally helpless. Helpless. I've got nothing. And you know you're going to get hit. It's just how and where. So Leroy fires another shot. Just as I turn around, it hit me in my back about a centimetre from my spine, goes across the top of the kidney and just rips me side out. So
can you describe the pain?
For me, the mental pain was worse than the physical pain at the time. But yeah, it is. It's like I'd say somebody's got a red hot needle and just pushed it through your body.
Oh.
That's how I'd describe it. And
have a quick drink and a quick dab.
The adrenaline.
Yeah. You're right. God, it's I can't believe you're lucky to be alive, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that brings me on to other stuff.
Yeah.
That's why you got to make the most of life, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Got a party.
All right, so you were saying that it was like a red hot
needle push through your body.
Pushing through your body.
And I managed to dive down in the road, because this all happened on the pavement, and get some protection. So I remember calling out for help on the radio, and...
Was that the first time you'd called for help in this situation?
It was, yeah. There's no other reason to, because obviously when it started, when Leroy was struggling with my colleague, my first intention was to go and help him, you know? And that's when Leroy just told me to disappear. So I lay down in the road, and then I could just feel the blood flowing out of my exit wound. So training kicks in. I've got a back injury. I've got to look after myself.
Where was
the exit wound was just around the side. So I put three fingers into my exit wound.
Into it?
Yeah, into
That's
it.
That's how you stop
to
it?
To stop the bleeding.
Not on top of it?
Basically in it.
Oh.
Yeah. And just squeezed and pushed as hard as I could.
Because
your training kicks in. It's survival. Yeah, basically like that. Yeah. So just push those in as hard as I could.
It's like putting your fingers horrible. In your own body.
Yeah, it is horrible. But survival.
Survival
kicks in. I've got to survive. Yeah. And that's something I'd say to anybody, if you're in a traumatic incident, is you've got to think survival.
Did you not get an item of clothing? Like, to put an item of clothing over it?
Obviously, in those days, we used to wear what we call the woolly pullies, the blue NATO jumpers, yeah? So, obviously, that just been ripped away. So, you just don't think. You just think, I've got to stop
the
bleeding.
Get something on it fast.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So your first day kicks in, and it's just that sign of positivity. Like, my colleague had the same thing. I'm not dying here. I am not dying in this road.
So, you get on the radio.
So I've done that, and obviously the troops are on the way. Now, then what's happened is, and I didn't know this until I read Leroy's book, yeah, is on the motorbike was an anti-theft device. So when you touch the bike, it won't start for about a minute or 2 minutes. And that's what had happened, because Leroy and his colleague are shouting at each other. And I'm thinking, just disappear, just do one, because I've called for help. The last thing I want is my colleagues turning up with a gunman. And what it was is that... Leroy's colleague wanted to run off, and Leroy's screaming at him, telling him not to. So as I'm on the radio, Leroy fires a warning shot. Now, when he fired that shot, I can't see my colleague, and my colleague's gone quiet, and I just think he's just wasted him. Yeah? Okay. I didn't know until afterwards that it was a warning shot in the air to his colleague. Not to us, to his colleague. So eventually they got on the bike, and they've disappeared, and then my colleagues have turned up. And then
what was going through your head as you're waiting for them, and how long did it take?
I can remember thinking, please, please don't turn up now until they went. No. I didn't want them. I didn't want them to come in here. And I'm thinking, I've called for help, but I don't actually want you here at the moment. It's a real, real weird feeling. And
but you're in a race against time as well.
Absolutely. And then the first car that turned up was, it was a really nice friend of mine, a bloke called Floody. He sadly, he got killed in a car accident, motorbike accident, sorry, a few years ago. But he nearly ran me over because I was in the road, and we all had a lot of laughs and jokes about it. And he came up to me and he's gone, "Oh, you're breathing, you're all right." And he went over to see my colleague, and we had so many laughs about that.
What was your blood situation by this point? And were you going faint?
No, I wasn't. No.
Adrenaline?
No, adrenaline keeps you going, yeah. And just that will...
You successfully kept the blood from coming out?
It was still coming out.
It was still leaking out?
Yeah.
Were you monitoring it while you're waiting for them?
Just kept my hand on it. I think that's all I can do.
At any point, did you think you were going to die?
The only time I thought I was going to die was when Leroy and his colleague didn't disappear. And I thought he would just come round and finish us off. Okay, and that's one of the reasons why I did forgive Leroy, because he could have done that. He had the time, he had the means, and he didn't do it.
Did your life flash in front of you at that moment then?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
How does that feel?
I had two young daughters, 2 and 4 at the time, and I just thought, I might not see him again. Wow. But then I thought, I've got to see him, got to. And it is that thing that, as I say, the traumatic incident, you have to think positive. I'm going to get out of this. I'm going to get out. I'm going to live. I'm going to get out of it. And that was part of training in those days that we were taught that. I don't know if they still teach it. I don't know. But being positive certainly helped. So they disappeared, and obviously I got taken to King's College Hospital.
So the ambulance come right away, or did the cops?
Yeah, every ambulance in South London went there.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And when I went to hospital, I had surgery. I was only in there for 4 days, but I had to go back every day for a month to have the wound dressed.
What surgery did you have?
I basically had the wound stitched on the inside, because then all the any bad fluids will drain out of either side, either Ooh. End. So with a bullet wound, obviously the entry is about the size of the bullet. The exit is 4 or 5 times the size. Mm. So it just rips out. Yeah. Okay. My colleague had a broken leg. So he was in hospital for 3 weeks. And then he went to Headley Court in Surrey, where they do the army rehabilitation centre, and he was the only person there then that had been shot, because that was pre-Iraq and Afghanistan, so he had specialist treatment there, and we both managed to go back, and we both went back to Brixton to work after 6 months.
Bloody hell.
So we had a choice, we could go anywhere we wanted, but we both said, look, we've got to prove this to ourselves that we can go and work in one of the toughest places.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
In the UK...
What was the reaction of your family members to you deciding to go back? Yeah.
I don't think they were too happy, no. I think they wanted me to take an easier life.
Did you have a conversation with them?
Yeah, I did, yeah, yeah. It was obviously discussed at length, but I just felt it was perhaps a bit selfishly, I've got to prove it to myself.
Right.
I mean, I had people say to me, you'll never work on the streets again, and I thought, well, why not?
What happened to the bullet?
That was obviously they recovered all 3. I managed to get the bullet after the trial, and I had a necklace made of it, but I lost it during a struggle with a prisoner a few years later.
Oh.
So it was a bit bit of a shame, really, but
so while all those ambulances are coming to you, I imagine there are mass police going after Leroy at this point, are there?
Obviously, because the bike wasn't registered, as it turned out, his colleague was under surveillance, and they'd lost him. And I think that's a good thing, because the last thing you want to see is a surveillance officer, just 2 uniformed colleagues getting shot, isn't it? Yeah. Mm. So they knew who the bike was being ridden by. So obviously he went and got taken out that evening. Mm. They found Leroy's prints on the back of the bike. And by then he'd gone to Holland, and then obviously on to Connecticut from there.
When you say that the bike had been taken out that evening, where did they find him at?
At his home address.
So did they swat that? Did they swat that then with the armed response? Or
yeah. So.
And how did the cops learn that Leroy was in Holland?
They found his prints on the bike, and they didn't know at the time he was in Holland. Mm. That came out.
A few weeks later.
Mm.
So there's a search going on, thinking that he's still in London.
Yeah.
But he's evaded.
Yeah.
How long did he evade for?
I think he was away for nearly a year, I think.
Good grief.
Yeah.
Was that frustrating for you to think that the culprit had not been apprehended?
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps he's going to get away with
it. Yeah, it was frustrating, but I also understood, that they're not going to hang about and stay in the UK. When I found out about his background, that he was over the side from prison, that made it more, why he wasn't caught there and then. So
when you learned who it was, what went through your head?
I was really pleased that he got extradited, obviously, and that he would face trial for what he did to myself and my colleague. sense of relief that, yeah, finally he was in custody now. Because you always, I know it wasn't personal, but you still thought, you know, you can easily find out where people live in life. And I'm just thinking, oh, what happens if he, you know, comes looking for me to do the job properly? Yeah. And I did think of that.
Did you discuss it with your other colleague who'd been shot?
Yeah.
What was his morale like after the incident?
Pretty much the same as mine, really. You know, we discussed about getting back to work, about getting on with our lives, really, and not trying to make too much of it. You do, obviously, you know. For me, I had a real sense of guilt that, A, could I have done more? And I know I couldn't, but you still doubt yourself. And the other thing for me is that my colleague's injuries were far more serious than mine. Now, I felt so much guilt over that. And he was a young lad, fit young lad, you know.
Did he lose a lot of blood? Because you can lose a lot of blood here, can't you?
I think he did, yeah. Yeah, but obviously the seriousness was in the breakage. So that was a thing for me on it. Real sense of guilt. But also a determination to prove to people that I could still do this job, a job that I love doing. Most of the time, yeah.
Obviously, but
yeah. And were you given any therapy after that incident?
Yeah, I had some counselling, and the counsellor I had, she was brilliant. She had done a lot of the victims from the Zeebrugge disaster, the ship that sank.
Oh, okay.
So she'd dealt with a lot of victims of that, and she was really good. And you know, one of the things for me with counselling is you get people with a lot of qualifications, but they haven't got the life experience. You know, I can tell you all about PTSD because I know what it's like, yeah? With somebody who hasn't suffered it, they haven't got that same knowledge of it. They might read books about it. They might be qualified in dealing with it, but it's different.
Yes.
How was your PTSD in those 6 months?
I think for me, it wasn't just the 6 months. It lasted for years because I had, as we discussed, a string of incidents.
So if you heard a loud noise, would it set you off?
Yeah, it still does, to be honest. Yeah, I don't like Bonfire Night, I'll be honest. I don't like it. But it was accumulation, and that's the same with police officers. Before we went on air, I was saying about that most people in their lives suffer about 10 lots of trauma. That's including family members dying, which we sadly all go through. But with police officers, it might be 300 or 400 lots of trauma that you experience, and that has to have an effect on you. And some people don't actually show it, but for me it was horrendous. It was horrible. And if it's like, I'm not you know, if somebody says you they've got a serious illness, something like cancer, which has affected nearly everybody in some way, shape or form, isn't it, in their lives, is you naturally sympathise with that person, you show them love, you show them care, you show them support. Well, with PTSD, you just go and get back on with your life. Mm. But it's deep down inside is this horrible creature that's eating away at you all the time. You know, really bad. And you talk to people and they don't always understand. You've got to have somebody who's a good listener. You know, not just a case of just listening to the right words, you know, or saying the right words. You got to understand them.
Of course.
Yeah.
Would you say that the only person who completely understands it is your colleague who was shot with you?
Yeah.
No, I would say other people that have been through similar things. Mm. Yeah, similar incidents. Yeah, and I've spoken to a lot over the years.
So you go back to work after 6 months. Are they going to give you an easy position now because of what you've been through, or have you think, right, I gotta get right back to it and prove myself?
Obviously nowadays they wouldn't let you do that, you'd have to go back gradually, but in those days I went back for 4 hours a day on the shift and then I made it to 6, and then by Christmas I was doing a full 8 hours.
And the situations arise that triggered you in a different way than you'd previously because of what you've been through.
PTSD. But the way I look at it and the way I look at trauma is don't deal with what might have happened. Deal with what did happen and learn to live with that. Because if we thought about what might happen, I wouldn't get my car and drive home now. No. Yeah? So what did happen? Yeah, I'm still here. My colleague's still here. Yeah, I've still got my health. Centimetre away could have been a different story, but it wasn't meant to be.
What was your first?
I'm lucky.
What was your first major challenge when you got back?
I think really it was just a case of just having the confidence of dealing with the public again and realising that it's not all bad people that live here. And I'd be surprised that when I went back to work, the amount of people that came out and spoke to me, like members of the black community especially. And I remember, and I put it in that book, I was in Cold Harbour Lane in a van one summer afternoon, and it was, there's been something going on between the black community and the police, and you could tense the atmosphere that something is just, the slightest thing could kick this off, you know. And I remember this young lady, he must have been about 17, 18, had the old Jamaican string vest on. And he just walked up to the side of the van in front of hundreds of people and just gave me an ice cold can of ginger beer. And nice. He just said, "That's for you. Oh. I respect you, bro." And I said, "What about me, Carly?" He said, "No, I don't know him." And walked off. And you know what? That meant so much to me. That meant so much to me. That lad doesn't know what he did.
Yeah.
What good he did for me in my life. You know, and I had loads of other people come up to me and shake my hand and, you know, say, "Really good to see you back." And my colleague did the same as well. He had the same thing. It's really nice, really nice to see. Because sometimes in policing, you only see the bad side of life. You don't see the good side in people. And it is, you can get sort of a bit one-sided with your thought on stuff sometimes.
So what was the next dangerous situation you got in after that?
Something I really learned from this incident, and I still smile about it, is we was down in Rushcroft Road, the same road, I was with a younger colleague again, and we saw a car parked up, and there was somebody leaning through the passenger window. And again, the way they looked at us was they're up to no good. That's that sixth sense coming through again. So we did a vehicle check like we did before. Hire car. Well, hire cars are used in crime, still are, aren't they? Yeah.
Definitely.
So my colleague said, "Oh, we've got to give him a tug. We've got to give him a tug and all that." And I've just gone, "We need some backup. There's three of them, there's two of us." And so we called up for some backup and all units were busy. So he's gone, "No, we've got to tug him." I went, "No," and he accused me of losing my bottle. He went, "No, you lost it. You lost your bottle." I went, "I haven't. Something ain't right with that car. I'm telling you, something is not right with that." And about half an hour later, that car was circulated that the passenger had been seen in possession of a firearm, of a handgun, yeah. So, and he was really embarrassed. And
I bet that brought back some memories.
It was just, had I not been shot before, I probably would have ploughed straight into a stop. Whether he had the gun on him then, I don't know, but I probably think he probably did have, because gunmen don't normally go around without their guns, as I'm sure Leroy's told you. So that was something that, shook me up a little bit, but it was like, yeah, I've learned, I've matured so much as a police officer. And, quite an amazing story, really.
Did your position rise over the years in the police?
No, I just stayed as a constable. So I was happy. I just stayed doing what I was doing.
Wow.
What year did you officially retire then?
2014. Yeah.
And this happened in
1994.
So 20 years of more policing since the incident. Oh my goodness. What were like the major stories you've got from that 20 years then?
Well, obviously some of them I've covered, like with the knife incident was after the shooting, when in the flat, that was after it, being shot at was after that.
How have you seen the police?
Another commendation I had was, again, I was at the driving school and I ended up changing drivers. So I only drive for a certain length of time. And I changed over in Brixton, of all places. And some fella comes up and says, "Oh, that fella's just robbed me." And so we thought, "Oh, okay, then. Well, you go to Brixton Police Station and report it. We'll go after him." So we went after this bloke and had a big, big fight with him, shall I say, and he was in possession of a knife. And, so that was, Never got away from it.
That's all right. No, I was just going to ask, so in your opinion, over the 20 years, how have you seen the police force change over the years? What sort of noticeable
obviously stuff with like with firearms calls, we got much more professional, much more equipment. We're a lot more professional.
Right.
Investigation wise, everything, technology, everything has completely changed policing to what it was. You know, the officer safety side, for example, was really changed.
Have the criminals had to adapt to that? And then the one cop we had on said it was like an arms race.
You guys
come up with a strategy to stop something and then they,
try they and get something else. It's almost like they're one step ahead of us sometimes, you know. Mm. And obviously cybercrime now is a massive thing, isn't it? Yeah. So, they do. They're always looking at further ways of upskilling themselves, aren't they?
What about the proliferation of drug gangs and knife crime?
Obviously, now it's all changed. It's spread out a lot more with the county lines. It's a massive, massive issue for the whole country. Massively so. I mean, I don't really get involved in that side of stuff much now, only through people that I might train and I talk to about their roles. So I don't really see a lot of that myself.
Wow.
So when you came to your retirement then... you know, looking back and everything you've been through, were you just like happy that you were alive and got through all this?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, yeah.
I bet your family were relieved as well that you were retiring.
I think so. Yeah,
In one piece.
So how old were you when you got chatting back with Leroy?
That was 2018. I read his book and contacted the publisher.
How did you find out about his book?
I had a victim support officer, because when Leroy got released, he was still on licence. So he was still under a curfew, times and places, etc. So the victim support officer, she kept in touch with me, let me know if he was abiding by what he should be. And she said about his book, so I thought, well, I'll read it. I never hated Leroy, because it wasn't personal. I was in the wrong place at the right time, or as I look at it, the right place at the right time. So a member of the public or another officer didn't get injured. That's the way I look at it. Yeah. So I've tried to turn that negative wrong place to the right place. So again, making a positive out of it. And so I just wrote to the publisher saying, look, tell Leroy if he is genuine about going straight and redeeming himself, then what better support, moral support to have than one of his victims?
Wow.
And there's a lot of distrust at first, but then all of a sudden, we just...
What was the first direct communication you had with him?
It was an email from Leroy. Basically.
What did it say?
He can't believe it. And I think he was a little bit scared. Yeah, couldn't understand it at first. Why I wanted to do that. But then we only sort of emailed once a month or something then. But then it just started to build up. And I didn't want to go public with it at first, because I had some negativity over it, but a lot of positive as well. But I just wasn't ready to come out and... you know, do interviews, etc. and stuff until I felt the time was right for me and I was happy with our relationship. And it's it just exploded, really.
Bonded over a bullet.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
At what point did you meet Leroy for the first time?
I met him in 2018 at Charing Cross Station.
Did that trigger your PTSD seeing his face?
No, it didn't. It absolutely did the opposite for me.
Did it?
It made me feel really proud, really like a closure to it all.
Ah, that's great.
And I've always been a little bit intrigued as to Leroy's life, what made him go into crime. And chatting to him, reading his book, has been a real eye-opener for me about life. And I tried to put myself in Leroy's shoes and think, if that had been me, what would I have done? And so I looked at it and I said to you earlier, didn't I, about he could have killed us both.
Yeah.
But he didn't. He shot to stop us, and that's what he achieved. And I've discussed at length with Leroy about what he could have done. Is every turn a call on the police car, he could have just fired a shot. But it's that fight or flight syndrome. Until you're pushed into that corner, when we went to stop and search him, it was just like any other stop and search. But then when I got over that line, yeah, that was it. So I've looked at it from that point of view that his mum's murdered when he's two. He might not remember it that clearly, but you know something's gone wrong. That's going to affect you for the rest of your life. He's looking out his front door, seeing teenagers walking around with 10 grand in their back pocket. I've got 10 grand in my bank account lying in my back pocket, you know. And to go down the educational route, you're facing discrimination for one thing. You're facing things that are really hard in life. It's a hard graft, which you can just go out there, sell some drugs and earn more money than if you go legit.
Easy money.
And I just looked at it and thought, what would I do if that was me? I can't say, but I could have ended up like that.
Yeah.
So I just looked at that and I thought, do you know what? I'll give you a second chance. And I'm so pleased that I have. Wow. Because I've seen, when you're a gangster, when you're in prison, you cannot show a sign of weakness. You cannot show a sign that you care. Because you're finished. You are finished. And I've seen a real caring side to Leroy that's never been exploited, that's never been shown to people, and it's there. And it's a real joy to see it in somebody who has been the complete opposite in their life. And it's great. Genuine.
So, James, it's like, you know, to rise above not wanting to have, like, vengeance or hatred towards the person who shot you, could have killed you, that takes a real strong character. I spoke to a person recently who'd been shot, and he said to me, look, Sean, if I was, you know, in a room with a guy who shot me right now, I'd try and kill him. I can't get over it. I've tried and tried to get over it. I cannot get over it. I've got this hatred for the person. I want him dead. So what has separated you from thinking like that?
It wasn't personal. Never hated him. And as I said, I was... the way I look at it, in the right place at the right time, was doing the job. And the danger of that happening to you, I was aware of when I signed the oath. Very, and I'm pleased to say it's still very, very rare. But, yeah, and I try to look at it from Leroy's point of view, everything in his life. And as I said, I don't know what I would have done if I'd been brought up in the same circumstances. And for me, maybe it's my upbringing that, you know, another thing for me was all the bad feelings and stuff. When I met Leroy, it was like closure. Everything, it just went. It was just a real sense of peace. And I remember getting on the train home thinking, I can't believe I've just done that.
Yeah.
Sometimes I still have to pinch myself and look at the book and think, I actually did that.
Could you have done it? Could you forgive someone who shot you?
It's hard to imagine, isn't it? So you've been but, through it.
Yeah. The other way I looked at it as well was he served 20 years out of a 25-year sentence. So most people, I would say, probably stand to be put right of it. Most people serve 50, 60%. So he served 80% as a cate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I just look at that and I think you've served your time for the crime you did. And I didn't contact him before. I just felt that, yeah, you've served your time. You deserved it. I'm not worried about those extra 5 years. That doesn't really bother me, you know? And I get so, I get a little bit fed up when I hear people say, yeah, they should throw the key away. Right. Why? Look at his life. Yeah, he did have choices. But when we're young, we don't always make the right choice. And hindsight is a fantastic thing, isn't it? And, you know, as I said, I've just seen such a different side to him that's never come out before.
Real story of forgiveness.
When you met him for the first time, what were the first things that were said? And when you looked into his eyes, what did you feel?
I just felt that he was really genuine. He said, look, I'm really sorry for what I've done to you. And I just said, we've got to move on, Leroy. We've got to move on. What's the point of dwelling on something that happened 20 years ago? Just all that anger and that pain. I'm here. I'm here to tell a story, and I'm telling one now. You know? And That's the way I see it. Let's make some good come out of this. You know, we a lot of police officers and police staff get accused of almost like being very prejudiced and not caring sometimes. But, you know, when we see the old, the tents around the murdered teenager, it hurts us. It really hurts us. But people don't see that. They think that, yeah, we're just hardened to it. It's just another murder to us. No, it's not. It's not. Trust me, it hurts me when I see it now. And so we just look at it, and I just look at it and think, if we can just help one kid get out of knife crime, we've done our bit, and we have done that. And hopefully there's going to be a lot more people. We'll not just look at us, but at other people that have turned their lives around.
How did you come to a decision to go public and work together?
I think once our bonding grew, and I was new, because one of the things with restorative justice is that for me, it's only just really started to kick off in the police service, yeah, throughout the country, you know, and I'm only talking the last few months, is you have to look and think, well, if this person isn't genuine, how am I going to cope with it? So that's one of the real big things that I looked at and asked a lot of questions to myself about. And I got help from a teenager's, who'd been stabbed, his parents, who said they'd have forgiven the person who killed him, because if they didn't, they'd never be able to smile again. And that really touched me, really touched me. And I've heard other stories like yourself, like with the Brighton bombing.
Brighton bomber and one of his victims.
And I've heard that before as well from, I don't know, John Sutherland, you know, John? Worth looking at.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
So
whose idea was it? Was it yours or Leroy's?
I think it was mutual.
Yeah,
to meet up, yeah. And then, you know, Leroy said this is going to go big together, and I thought, yeah, it probably will, but it's taken time, obviously, with COVID and that.
What was the response when you went public?
The first thing was a BBC interview, and, yeah, it was. I got a lot of real, real good feedback from it. A lot of people have said and been honest, yeah, I couldn't do that. A lot of police officers said I couldn't
you said
do that.
Bit of hate mail, didn't you?
A little bit of hate mail, yeah. But
is your colleague got shot in the leg? Is he happy for you?
He is, yeah. It's not the route he wants to take, and I respect him fully for that. And it's not been easy. You know, it's cost me a few sleepless nights. But having done it now, I can only see the benefits. I can't see any negatives in it, we're doing.
It's powerful, isn't it?
Because it is powerful. It's one of those things that I just find talking to people about it. People tend not to talk that much about it because it is so deep. It's so heavy. And like you say, I don't know if I could... So they don't think about it. Yeah?
Yeah.
And it's another thing that that I've been talking about lately is that there's a lot of people out there that have convictions like for assault and police, but actually really nice people. And I know that from experience. Really lovely people. They might have had the wrong drink or just the wrong frame of mind. And the first bit of authority is within the first police officer that's turned up. And they haven't abided by what they want them to do. It's not personal.
You can't define people by one mistake.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what is your goal and mission now?
I don't know. I've thought about writing a book and getting Leroy to write a chapter for me. As you said, I've had a few incidents that I could fill a book with, and some happy and some funny stories probably as well. But obviously, it'd take time to look at, and you know, just need the time to do that. Where it goes from here, I don't know. If I'm honest, I'd like to see a bit more involvement with schools. I know I've got a full time job, Leroy doesn't so much, but you know, doing work with younger kids and stuff, you know, prisons. We've done some work for a youth offenders place in California. A couple of the boys are trying to sort their lives around and coming over to meet us next month.
Coming from California to here?
Yeah, with their mentors, yeah,
oh,
to meet
fantastic.
Us. So we did a few Zoom interviews with them. And
are they coming to London then?
They are, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long are they going to be in London?
I'm not sure. But we have made a difference in some people's lives.
Yeah.
And hopefully a lot more.
Definitely.
Of course.
And for the people watching this, then, how can they support you guys or reach out to you? Do you have on? We'll put links there. Do you have socials and stuff that people?
I'm not on social media at all.
Okay.
I think Leroy did say that.
So the website for you guys is stuff. If people want to get you.
If you want to get in touch, go through Out of the Box website.
Yeah.
And then if anyone wants to get in contact with me, obviously do it via Leroy.
Yeah.
It's the best way. Yeah.
Okay. Anyone got any final questions then for James?
You mentioned earlier about like, the Masons and police. Is that a big thing?
Oh, yes.
I don't really want to. Yeah. I'm not one, by the way. So, yeah. I'll be honest. I don't agree with Freemasons and the police.
No.
How can you have a secret society in the police? I've never understood that. Yeah. I'll probably get the sack for saying that now, but so be it.
Oh, James.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, we salute you. We salute your bravery. We salute your authenticity and the fact that you're on this mission now. You harnessing the power of your story to change people's minds and to deter people, especially young people from crime. And these kids that come from California, that's the deep end, those gangbangers. Yeah, because I was in Arizona, so I know what about that culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's going to be fascinating how that turns out. But so if you've watched this, please let us know what you think. If you want Leroy or James to do a speaking engagement, go to the Out of the Box website. We will have that down there. And all of Jen's links down there. So please support what Jen's doing today. I was wondering where her little string is to Jeffro style, tie up the dungarees, you know, Beverly Hillbillies.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, James. That was phenomenal. Yeah, cheers, man. Yeah, give us a hug. Yeah, cheers. Well done.
Lovely to meet you. Thank you so much.
All right, pleasure.
Never before has there been a way to get your messaging out there until Guerrilla Media Limited's out-of-the-box approach. Our LED screens are a powerful advertising tool that will expose your brand message to the thousands of people walking and driving past the large 1 meter LED boards across London, or positioned in the back of cars. The bottom line is that you want to attract and influence and stand out. And Guerrilla Media's leverage of advanced technology provides a consistent and standout advertising platform for your marketing campaign or established business. Our digital billboards are positioned to take advantage of long dwell times, ensuring maximum exposure for your brand or company name. You can even maximize your messaging with 24-hour operation. Just imagine that. Your own LED billboard with excellent viewing, bringing in high traffic and additional sales. Or tailor your ad campaign with 1 minute ads played on repeat throughout a month for as little as £100. The bottom line is that Guerrilla Media's out of the box LED advertising screens get your message across better than ever before. Now you can deliver eye-catching messages or display your company name like no other regular sign ever could. With unrivaled clarity, our LED screens are extremely reliable and sustainable, allowing you to design your own content. Did you know that digital signage grabs 72% more attention than online ads? It's a tool that every industry, whether it's retail, hospitality, healthcare, technology, education, sports, or corporate environments, is adopting to communicate effectively with consumers. Digital signage has become a go-to marketing solution for businesses. Our LED displays help your company make its presence felt in the competitive world of business, representing the perfect solution for all your marketing woes. For more information, call us at 07432 419 432 or visit the website.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Here at Boomer and Jen, We offer a wide range of organic or recycled clothing. We all know our planet is important. We only have this one. So it's vital that we all work together to slow down and reverse the changes to the environment. Whilst we all know that big industry are having a significant effect on pollution, here at Boomer and Jen, we believe that if we all make small changes, we can do our part. Fast fashion causes detrimental effects to the planet. Not only is nearly 20% of global wastewater produced by the fast fashion industry, but there is a considerable amount of fast fashion ending up in landfill. So let's move away from fast fashion items that are only worn once or twice and start wearing extremely comfortable, durable and environmentally friendly clothing and ethical jewellery. Boomer and Jen was founded in a quiet town in Devon in 2018. It has now gone from strength to strength as the world is becoming more aware of the current climate situation, helping our customers to buy sustainable, quality clothing. All of our products are fair trade and registered with the Global Organic Textiles Standard Association. Check us out on organiccottonclothing.co.uk.